Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. A neurological condition known as synesthesia may affect only a very few of us, but it may also hold the key to more common neurological problems. Synesthesia relates to abnormal connectivity when senses are confused. We'll be talking about that on today's program, about what it is, what we are learning about it, and how that knowledge might be applied to a better understanding of autism and other neurological disorders. Much of the research is being done right here in St. Louis. With me in studio are Professor Britt Brogard of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. She is with the Departments of Philosophy and Psychology and UMSL Center for Neurodynamics. She is also director of the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab. Her associate director is Christian Marlowe, a graduate student at UMSL. Joining us later by phone will be Derek Amato. After suffering a concussion, he woke up with an ability to play classical piano, although he had had no previous training. Also by phone, Daniel Kish. He is blind, but navigates a bike in traffic by sound, much the way bats navigate. I want to thank you folks very much for being with us. I'm looking forward to talking to you and to the two gentlemen who will be joining us a little later.
Thank you very much.
Britt, let me begin with you. I have to confess I'm having trouble getting my arms around this whole thing. Give me your explanation of it, keeping in mind that most of the people listening are not in your field, and if you can explain it in ways that will be more easily understood than some of the things I've been reading.
Synesthesia and savant syndrome, which is what Derek Amato has, are two different conditions, and they don't always go together. Synesthesia is a mixing of the senses, so it's an unusual mixing of the senses. So a common form is grapheme color synesthesia, where you will see a letter or a number that's printed in black as colored, so three may be blue. But there are lots of different kinds of synesthesia. Some people have taste sensations in response to words. Some people have sounds in response to colors or the other way around. Savant syndrome is a condition that involves special talents or abilities. It's associated with autism, but autism is not a necessary condition for savant syndrome. Mm. It's familiar from the movie The Rain Man, and also British author who had synesthetic condition where he's seeing numbers in colors and textures, and also has the ability to calculate huge numbers. Daniel Tammet may be familiar to some mm-hmm. listeners. So the condition synesthesia and the other condition, savant syndrome, sometimes go together. And that is the case in Derek Amato's case. And Daniel Kish does not have savant syndrome, but he has special abilities and presumably also a form of synesthesia that would be sort of correct, unlike most synesthetic experience, which is, in a sense, incorrect from our perspective. So if you see a number that's printed in black as red, for instance, you could say, or we would say, that that's mistaken perception. But Daniel Kish has some visual imagery, despite being blind, which reflects what he is hearing via echolocation.
The synesthesia savant syndrome must be exceedingly rare.
Synesthesia is more common than savant syndrome. It's unclear how many people actually have it because the research into synesthesia is relatively new. So people disagree about how many people actually have it. The most common form is the one I mentioned, where you have colored responses to letters or numbers. But it's rare. It's rare for sure. Maybe it's 1% of the population, which would be at the high end. Savant syndrome is even more rare, and there's one study that shows that the number of savant people with savant syndrome is about 100. That's probably at the low end, because there are cases of acquired savant syndrome, and we don't have a good sense of how many people have that.
Acquired savant syndrome. What does that mean? Is it someone has a concussion, as was the case with Derek, and then woke up able to play the piano?
That's one case of it. So we just completed another study on Jason Pettit, who was beaten up. And after that, he started seeing the world in geometry and was able to draw that. And so that's one example of acquired savant syndrome. Derek Amato, he jumped into the low end of the swimming pool and acquired musical talents that he didn't have before. There are people with stroke who suddenly are able to paint, for instance, after having suffered a stroke. Acquired savant syndrome can also occur as a result of just changes in the brain, but that's extremely rare. Usually acquired savant syndrome is the result of a stroke or some other illness or an accident.
Christian, I've heard stories of people who have been had some sort of trauma, perhaps illness, and who have awakened and spoken in a foreign language they'd never been exposed to. Is this part of what we're talking about?
It might be. So the thought is that there's certain areas of the brain that that normally are unconscious to us, but through some sort of blunt force injury or traumatic brain injury, they become we gain some sort of conscious access to something that's stored in our memory. So in these cases where people awaken able to able to speak language, it's not that that they're just making this language up as they go along. It's that they probably have somehow been exposed to it in the past and have stored these types of things in their low-level memory, and then somehow they're able to put them together when they become conscious of it.
Wouldn't that be the same with the ability to play the piano?
So in the case of Derek Amato, it appears to be that way. So
appears to be what way?
So it appears that
exposure to the to music, piano?
So you probably had exposure at a young age to some sort of musical connections or musical the grammar of music. And then once he underwent trauma, he gained access to some sort of normally unconscious process that was responsible for generating new music inside of his mind. Yep. So we do know that in the case of music neurotypical people, so people who have not had these types of injuries or people who and people who do not play music, process certain grammatical aspects of music in the same area of their brain where they process grammatical aspects of language. And so if I play to you a bunch of chords that go together and then I play an off chord, someone who's not a musician will respond in an area of their brain that's responsible for detecting normally responsible for detecting grammatical errors in spoken language. And so it seems like it appears that there are certain areas of the brain that are already responsible for generating musical compositions that we normally don't have access to until they're developed through proper learning. But in these cases of brain injury, it appears that for whatever reason, we're becoming conscious of those processes. And so in Derek Amato's case, is able to tap into that and then play what's being generated.
This is certainly the most dramatic aspect of what you were studying. Let's put that aside until we get Derek and Daniel with us,
right,
and we can talk more about that. And return to synesthesia itself in its less dramatic form, the colors that you mentioned. Is this debilitating in any way?
Normally it's not, but we do have subjects who suffer from the condition. It's rare. Usually it sounds color synesthesia, so sounds that will give rise to colors. We have one subject who has an intense color formation in response to sound, and that means that he cannot attend big rooms or big arrangements, big parties, or he cannot pass construction sites because it will block his visual field. His visual field will fill with colors and will make him legally blind, even though his vision is perfectly normal when things are quiet around him. So he cannot go out among people because of the colors that will block his visual field. But that's a rare case. And normally it's considered an advantage, and it has certain advantages. For instance, in people who are creative, they sometimes use that as inspiration for painting or poetry or other forms of art. It also can help memory.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me another couple of examples? I mean, I understand so far what you've said, certainly, but other examples of this confusion that we're talking about where things are out of place somehow.
There are so many types of synesthesia. There are some people who have color responses to pain. There are people who have color responses to the different kinds of emotions.
Let me just stop you right there. Color responses, but not as dramatic as what you just described with the gentleman who has this intense color, so intense that he's legally blind. What is a lesser color response?
Yeah, so there are two types of synesthesia. One type is called projector synesthesia, and that means that the colors are seen as out in the world. If it's colors or the response is seen out in the world or heard is out in the world. And the other is called associator synesthesia, and that's more in your mind's eye. And it's less dramatic, but you can test for it, and you can see that it's an automatic connection.
Mm-hmm. Christian, any example that you can give me that strikes you?
So probably the most common example of associator synesthesia, maybe to make it more clear, is it again in the grapheme color type. So people won't actually when they see the letter A written in black, they won't actually see the color red floating in space above the letter, which is the case in projector synesthesia, or in some case of projector synesthesia. But they'll have a feeling that that letter is associated with that color red. And it's not just that it's not some feeling that's been created idiosyncratically. It's a feeling that is testable over time, and it's subject to you can test for it. So you can test for it in a way that neurotypical individuals won't be able to pass the test, because there's such a strong connection between that. And it also is not just it doesn't have to do with color, but it can be any type of modal experience. So it can be in the terms of graphing color synesthesia, again, it can be red, but it could also be a texture, or it could even be a personality. So some people claim that A is very happy and M is very mopey, but it's very idiosyncratic.
Is this something we're born with, Britt?
I don't think we are born with synesthesia, though that is a hypothesis. I think that it develops during early childhood. So that we're talking about three different kinds of synesthesia, mm-hmm. and I'm talking about developmental synesthesia. There are two other types, acquired synesthesia and drug-induced synesthesia. But developmental synesthesia is something that develops in early childhood. That's what our hypothesis is. And that's we don't know exactly why it develops. One possibility is that certain babies, infants, have an extreme sense input or extreme amount of sense input, and that they have an excessive amount of neurotransmitters that creates extra connectivity in the brain.
How do we know if we have it? Is it simple as looking at a numeral or a letter and finding it's a different color than the color is printed?
Most people who have synesthesia will know it, not necessarily under that name. Many synesthetes think that everyone have the same condition. So not everyone will be able to say, I'm a synesthete. But you would be able to, at least in far the most cases, to tell if you have synesthesia. It's not something that a lot of people are thinking about, because it doesn't give rise to any handicap in everyday life. And a lot of people don't know that other people don't see the world that way.
Mm-hmm. Christian, does it go away, ever go away?
I don't know of any cases where it does. I guess there are some cases where it has been theorized that all children are born with it, and that over time, there's some sort of a restructuring process where it's pruned away and we simply don't have memory of it. There's some examples of people who have had an acquired form of synesthesia, and then later on it's diminished or gone away. But one mark of synesthesia typically is that it's stable over time.
Britt, you look like you want to add something to that.
Yeah, it's stable over time, but it's quite common that children and teenagers have it, and then it disappears when they get into their 20s. It might be fading in some cases as well. So the people who are associators may have been projectors early on. So that can happen, but it's not something that you have one day if it's developmental and then not the next day. You'll usually have it for several years.
I have to take a break now. We'll continue our conversation on synesthesia when we come back. My guests in studio, Professor Britt Brogard of the University of Missouri-St. Louis, director of the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab. I wish it were an easier word to pronounce sometimes. And UMSL graduate student Christian Marlowe is with us. He is the lab's associate director. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment, and certainly we'll take your input and give us a couple of moments for that at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, or you can reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on synesthesia, which, very generally speaking, relates to an abnormal connectivity among the senses. My guests in studio are Professor Britt Brogard of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. She is director of the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab. Her assistant is graduate student Christian Marlowe, who is also with us in studio. We are going to be joined now by Daniel Kish. I referenced him early in the program. This gentleman is blind and has been almost since birth, but he can move through traffic by sound. Daniel, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Tell me how this works for you.
Well, goodness, a lot of blind people can move through traffic by sound. My claim to fame is actually the use of human echolocation, which basically allows me to move through completely silent objects, whatever they may be, and to recognize them by the pattern of sound that reflects from them, which we would call an echo pattern.
This is, as my understanding is, that you're a biker and that you do a lot of mountain biking and that this seems to work for you very, very well.
Well, yes, I used to do a lot of mountain biking. These days I do mostly traveling to different countries teaching the technique. I have a team of instructors who are also blind who teach the use of echolocation. We call it flash sonar because it involves a flash of sound, much like a flash of light, and it kind of, in a sense, takes a picture, a sort of moving picture of the environment, and allows a person to analyze any scene that they are in and to move through that scene with an awareness of the elements of the scene.
Are you actually, in your mind's eye, seeing a picture?
Well, I have no visual memories, so it's a bit difficult for me to describe it that way, although I do describe it that way. But I have no way of knowing if it's anything like a person who sees with their eyes actually seeing. We do have some students who lost their vision later in life, and they would describe it in that way, that they are seeing, that they actually have an image that is visual in nature in their mind as they're using this technique.
You say this is a technique that that can be taught. Can you give me some sense of how you teach that?
Well, there's a lot of pedagogy around the teaching of the technique. So there are a lot of factors that need to be in place to support the development of the technique. And in a few cases, it develops naturally. And I think that it can develop naturally, given the right circumstances. Basically, we start with simple stimuli. We basically hook the brain or activate the brain to simple stimuli, which we, in our case, are panels that are placed around the head. And the student needs to be able to determine where the panel is. And they then need to be able to reach out and touch the panel. And it is our view, especially after the more recent brain scan research on neural processing of echolocation, that it's this directed reaching which helps to activate the visual system, and it is the visual system that is involved. And from these exercises, we move to more and more complex exercises where individuals are encouraged, are supported through experiences to move through their environment with precision. So, for example, we might have a group of poles that the student has to move among, or if we can find a grove of trees, an opening in a fence. If there's a sign on the fence, I might ask the student to walk along the fence and point out the sign and then reach out and touch the sign. I might ask the student to count the poles holding up the fence as they move along. So once you've hooked the brain's attention using a simple but stronger stimulus, and the brain basically says, aha, I know what I'm listening for, and I know what the relevance is, then you can, once you've, I call it hooking the attention of the brain, once you've hooked the attention of the brain, you can then manipulate that attention to weaker, more subtle and more complex stimuli. The process unfolds. Once you've established that hook, the process tends to unfold quite rapidly. So it's my belief that we all have this ability within us. It's our job, essentially, as instructors to activate that ability.
How long might it typically take for someone to reach the point where they could do things that might otherwise have been considered dangerous?
Well, I guess anything's dangerous if you don't really know what you're doing.
But you know what I'm getting at. I think
we find our students certainly being able to do things that other people wouldn't have thought possible within 20 to 30 hours of training.
Wow. That is absolutely stunning. Bridget, do you want to get into this? And your thoughts about, certainly you've worked with this gentleman before. Remark, if you would, on what he's been talking about.
Yeah, Daniel mentioned that we all have it in us. That's also a hypothesis that we have about the other remarkable skills, including Daniel's remarkable skill, that it is a potential of the human brain to develop these talents. We don't normally work on it. Daniel told me that they have taught sighted people the same skills, and they might not be as proficient, but they can actually learn it. And there are similar ways that you can induce savant skills in ordinary individuals. So we do have it in us.
Daniel, was this something that you had to train for, or did you somehow just have it, realize at
one
point that you had it?
Well, I am one of these people who developed naturally, and the somehow I think I understand how that works. It really has to do with an environment that is supportive of the imaging system in the brain to develop its connection with the environment and to develop its role in helping us govern our interactions with the environment. Essentially, to put it in simple terms, you're essentially raising a blind child as if they could see, more or less. So you don't raise the child under restrictions and limitations that are typically imposed upon blind children, which lead to a quintessential role of a blind person being essentially passive and being essentially immobile or relegated to less or awkward mobility. In my case, and in the case of some others, we just were raised with the assumption that we could learn to access the environment and to interact with the environment in a more natural way. And within that style of child rearing, these kinds of abilities are much more likely to develop on their own.
Is this a technique that any sightless person could learn?
We've worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students from over 30 different countries, from all kinds of, well, pretty much every background you could imagine, and also even with multiple disabilities and of every age. We've worked with students who are infants, a fair number of infants, all the way up to the elderly. And, yeah, I would say about 90% of the students make quite rapid progress. The caveat there, however, is the supportiveness of the environment around them to developing and establishing these skills. We live in a society that tends to be predisposed to restriction of blind individuals, and that includes culture, it includes family, and it includes overall society. It also includes community outlook and community perspective. So what will often happen is they will learn the technique, it will develop within the 2 or 3 days that we work with the student, and then we leave, and then the student is sort of re-relegated to their original role. And so at that point, the technique will fade. So a big part of our training is trying to help the student modify, if you will, the impact of their surrounding community upon them, so that there is fertile soil, if you will, for the technique to continue to grow and establish.
I want to ask you, Daniel, to stay with us, if you will. We're going to bring into the conversation now Derek Amato, whom I also referenced earlier in the program. He's the gentleman who woke up after a concussion and with the ability to play classic piano, although he had never had any instruction in same. So Derek is joining us from Ontario, Canada. Thank you so much for being with us, Derek.
Hi, Don. It's a pleasure.
Hi. And you can say hi to Britt and to Christian also.
Hello,
with me in
Britt,
studio.
Hi.
Derek, I'll ask you, just as we have with Daniel, to kind of tell us your story in a capsulized form. I've synopsized it, but give us your version of that story, your first-person version.
You know, I'm getting so used to telling it, I try to mix it up each time now, and it's becoming challenging. when I discovered, after my accident, you know, it was like 5 days when I discovered I could play music. So, I mean, the transformation for me was really, it was one of those things that just kind of shocked you, because it took me a year to adjust to simply discovering music. But after the accident, I found out on the fifth day, I kind of snapped out of it. And from then on, I guess, after starting to work with Dr. Treffer, it became just my quest to dive into looking at the human potential. Obviously, I became just intensely interested in it.
If I were you, I'd be careful about using the expression "dive in." I think that's what caused the problem in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't mean to play on that.
No, I get it. But now you're performing professionally.
I only do a few live performances a year. I do probably 4 to 6 appearances, I guess, or performances. And then I do maybe 6 to 10 speaking engagements, and the rest of my time is filled with doing charity involvement stuff, you know, traveling.
This is all very difficult, I think, for most of us to grasp, but what you and Daniel have been talking about. I am under the impression from something Christian said earlier that you did have some exposure to music sometime before your accident, your concussion.
I did. I grew up with music around me. My mother played, you know, a little bit of, I call it church organ, or a little bit of piano when I was a kid. And my grandmother played organ as well, you know. So, I mean, I grew up with music around me, and I was always fascinated with it. And I played, you know, drums when I was a kid in fifth grade. My mom got me a snare drum, and then I tried the guitar in seventh grade. So, I mean, yes, I did have I don't think I was any good at it, but I certainly had a love and passion for music.
Am I right? And you had exposure to it, but no practical performing experience?
No, I had never touched a piano up until, you know, October, whatever, 31st or November 1st.
What happened then? You just walked up to a piano and started playing it?
I went to say I was going to head back home to Colorado from the Midwest, and I went to visit Rick, and he had a keyboard up in his little studio, and I just was drawn to play it, and it was just like that. I sat down, and it was fluid from that moment on. It wasn't a building thing. It didn't take months to acquire. It was that moment.
Before we take our next break, let me come back to Britt and to Christian. Is this something that is likely to stay with Derek forever, or is it possible he'll wake up one day and this talent will be gone?
It's possible, but what we know is that those talents tend to stay with people for a very long time, provided that they don't take medications that could prevent it. So it's likely that there's some change in connectivity and change in neurotransmitter levels. And, of course, you could take a drug that would make that, normalize that, and that probably would be the end of the talent.
Are there medications for people with, I'll call it simple synesthesia, although there's nothing simple about it, obviously?
No, but there are medications that can lower or regulate levels of neurotransmitters. So the excessive amounts of neurotransmitters that presumably have given rise to this talent or by indirect ways. Of course, you can normalize those levels taking various kinds of drugs, if anti-seizure drugs, certain kinds of antidepressants might work that way as well. And as long as people don't do that, I don't see that the talent would disappear or that the levels would normalize after this amount of time.
Do you want to weigh in on this part of it, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, I know in Derek's case, so one trade-off that some people have. So in Derek's case, he does have a certain type of kind of obsession now with music and compulsion to play. And he also suffers from some pretty bad headaches at times. And so in his case, he's opted not to take any medication. That one doctor suggests that he take an anti-epileptic drug, but that could potentially suppress his ability to play. So it is possible, but in that case, he's just decided not to take the medication. So.
I'm going to take that break now, and I'll ask Derek and Daniel to stay with us if you've got the time for the next few minutes. We'll take some phone calls. We have some people who want to get into the conversation. We're talking about synesthesia, and we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. With me in studio, Professor Britt Brogard of the University of Missouri-St. Louis, director of the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab, which is located on the campus of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Amzul graduate student Christian Marlowe is the lab's associate director. He's with me in studio. Derek Amato is joining us by phone from Ontario, Canada. He woke up after a concussion with an ability to play the piano, as we've been discussing. Also with us is Daniel Kish, who is joining us from Long Beach, California. Daniel is blind, but has discovered and worked with a technique that enables him to use almost a kind of bat-like or dolphin-like radar to navigate this planet of ours. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about synesthesia. My guests are Professor Britt Brogard of the University of Missouri-St. Louis on the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab. Graduate student Christian Marlowe is with us. He's the lab's associate director, joining us by phone, Derek Amato and Daniel Kish. I want to go right to the phones because I think we have a contributor here who will relate to Daniel. Justin in St. Louis, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, I actually am in transportation and have had a number of interesting experiences. And let me just say, as usual, wonderful show. You better get ready to change the name so it can just be a national syndication. But my experience was I had a passenger that I would transport frequently that was completely blind, was not born that way, lost it in teen years. And literally with permission, I would mess with him, and I would drive slower or faster, or you know, do different tricks to try and mess him up. But he would give me turn-by-turn directions without being able to see at all, and it amazed me every single time. And I've seen many other experiences, but that was the one that really stood out to this experience. It was he just knew. It was like he had a muscle memory sense, and he just felt his way everywhere he went.
Well, thank you for the call. I'll ask Daniel to respond to that. This, I guess, sounds like what you're talking about.
Well, it is what I'm talking about in the sense that the imaging system is often attached to vision or to eyesight, but it really is a system that is designed to take sensory input of any kind and establish or construct an image from that input. And the image has spatial character, and so it might be kinesthetic information, haptic information, auditory information, tactile information, along with linguistic information. And so, yes, of course, many of our students, most of our students, can do as Justin is describing.
What a life-changing experience this has to be for people who suddenly find themselves with the ability to do things they might not have dreamed of.
Well, it just expands their freedom. So they tend to go from feeling relatively restricted in the world to feeling quite free to access and interact with the world.
Let's bring in another caller. Gary, go ahead and come into the conversation, please.
Yes, Don. I wanted to ask the gentleman, Mr. Kish, I believe, what type of sound transmission he uses to get the echolocation, if they have a device or if it's done by clapping I can't imagine what they're using. And the gentleman who suddenly found himself with the ability to play the piano, I was wondering, does he play by ear, or does he have a recording of the whole piece he wants to play in his head and he can transmit that into the notes, or does he find himself suddenly able to read music?
Derek, let's start with you first, and then we'll go to Daniel.
I see black and white squares that continually go, they move left to right, and that's what my fingers play. So I guess you could say I play by ear, but at the same time, when I sit down, I don't know what I'm going to play, and those black and white notes that are in my mind's eye, it moves like a ticker tape. And it doesn't stop, and it goes when I'm sleeping. It goes when it's 24 hours a day, so my brain is constantly composing. So I guess you could say I play by ear, but the way I look at it, my hands do exactly what those black and white squares are.
Just to be clear, these are black and white squares. They are not notes per se.
No, they're not notes. They're perfect little squares. I mean, just exact squares, and they move left to right like a nonstop ticker tape.
And what are your fingers doing in response to these squares?
My fingers go where those black squares are, where I see them.
As if they were over the keyboard, for instance?
Well, like if I'm having a conversation right now with you, I see notes moving. So I visually see these notes. My fingers play exactly where those black and white squares are located. So some of those squares are low as they're moving, and some are higher. And my hands seem to play exactly where those notes should be, those black and white squares.
Let's go back to Daniel now with regard to the sound that is transmitted to get this echo effect, Daniel.
It's a click sound, similar to what you'd hear bats and dolphins using, except that it's, of course, within the human audible spectrum. It's a tongue click. And it won't transmit very well over the phone, but so it sounds a bit like a finger snap, and it can be varied in volume from very soft to very, very loud. It's very, very rapid. It's only about 6 or 7 milliseconds long. And different people who do echolocation may use slightly different signals, but the signal within each person tends to be quite consistent.
You know, I'm just reminded by listening to you, there are people in Africa who communicate this way. This is their language, the clicking.
Well, indeed, phoneticists have classified these clicks, and the type of click that I that I emit is called a palatal click. The lower, more sort of clock-like percussive click would be referred to as an alveolar click.
And you say you have it can be very loud. How far can it be transmitted? I mean, 100 feet, 20 feet?
Hundreds of meters. Yes, but there comes a point where you don't really image very well at those distances. And, of course, the attenuation through air is quite high. So I would say at the range of about 100 meters or so, you might resort to a stronger signal such as a hand clap.
Okay, well, this is coming into somewhat sharper focus. I'm still having some difficulty grasping it all, as I think many people do, but it's fascinating indeed. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Mary calling from Crestwood. Mary, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Dan. Just a couple of comments. Thank you. Your questions are remarkably incisive, and you pick such wonderful topics for your show. I really appreciate that. The first thing I wanted to comment on was I have taught psychology at the university level for a number of years, and the first time I realized that I had synesthesia was when I was describing in a course on perception, you know, and I said to the students, oh, you know how when you hear a sound, you see colors? I had no idea until that moment that everybody did not have the same experience. And so that goes to a number of points that your other speakers have brought up already. The second thing is that it's best or finest for me in the during the hypnagogic state, that time just before you're about to fall asleep. The colors and the shapes that are connected with sounds are just vibrant and very attractive and very compelling. And the third thing I wanted to comment on is the loss of that ability. I had a change of life when I moved here to St. Louis, and that I don't have that ability anymore. And I'd like to ask, is that normal? I know that your speaker said it changes over time. Is it normal to have that kind of loss during change of life? Thank you very much for taking the call.
Mary, thank you for calling. Britt, do you want to take that question?
Yeah. Synesthesia is remarkably consistent over time, but it certainly can change. And fading of colors is very common. And so we do have some cases of people who start as projector synesthetes and then become associator synesthetes, and then it's merely the connection at the end. Some people lose it. After many years, maybe they have it as a child, and then they have it as a teen, and then they lose it when they go into their 20s. We believe that it's a bit like memories, connections between events, for instance, stored in memory, that those memories can fade as well. And so that's one hypothesis that we have about synesthesia, that it can sort of undergo the same sort of fading as memories and may even disappear. We might lose memories as time passes.
I want to talk a little bit about research, but before I get to that part of it, I'll go back to Derek because I have a note here asking the compositions, the music that you play, is this typical standard classical music from the great composers, or is all of it or most of it your own composition?
Yeah, I would say it's mostly all my own compositions. I mean, I can play pretty much all kinds of different genres, from classical to jazz to pop, what have you. I can change it. I can change the structure of it from a pop to a jazz piece or a jazz to a classical.
But if you wanted to play a composition by, let's say, Brahms or Duke Ellington even, you would still see these same squares. I just wonder where they're coming from. I mean, how those squares would know what notes you're wanting to play, if it is Brahms or Duke Ellington.
Well, the way Dr. Reeves from the Mayo Clinic explains it in a pretty easy way. When I hit my head, he basically says it opened up a window, a space to where I was overstimulating and producing an amount of information at a pace that was unheard of. And when that window of time was opened, it created
a nonstop pace of notation. And that's where those black and white squares come from, too, in reference to his medical explanation.
But are you looking at sheet music of any particular number that they turn into these squares?
I don't understand sheet music. I don't know how to read music, and I don't even know where the keys are on the piano.
Britt, you're smiling. Is there something you wanted to say to that?
No, I wanted to comment on the visions of the black and white squares. And so it's definitely related to synesthesia, and that's one of the questions that we want to figure out when Derek is coming out to our lab in March, is whether it is a general form of synesthesia or it's visual imagery, and how that relates to the altered brainwaves that we believe that he has.
I want to take a moment, and Derek and Daniel, please stay with us. Our time is somewhat limited, but there may be a time for another call or two. I want to talk about research. I alluded in the introduction to the fact that some of what you're learning could be applied to such things as schizophrenia, autism, and ADD. Where are we in that, and how do you see the connection?
So people with acquired synesthesia and savant syndrome have some of the traits that autists have as well. They don't have, usually don't have all of them. So the case that we completed recently, Jason Paget, satisfied almost all of the criteria back then for autism, except the communication factor. So he acquired some of the features of autism. And the one theory that of autism is the intense world theory, which is a theory that people are autistic because they have a very extreme connectivity in the brain, a lot of sense inputs, and so they have too much information to deal with, and so they sort of localize that information and focus on details in order to protect themselves for this massive input or an activity in the brain. And it looks like people with acquired savant syndrome who are not born autists actually develop something similar. And so it seems that we are moving towards a more unified theory of synesthesia and savant syndrome, which would also apply to other forms of synesthesia, not just developmental and acquired synesthesia, but also drug-induced synesthesia.
Krishna, where are we in all of this? On a scale of 1 to 10, putting some of these, solving some of these mysteries?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but it is, we still are learning so much about the brain right now that we're just starting to be able to put things together. So like Britt was saying, it appears that conditions like synesthesia and savant syndrome come together. Autism also seems to come along with that, or to some degree, obsessive compulsive disorder and attention deficit as well. And in all of these conditions, kind of the common thread is that we're finding that it all seems to be an information overload. And so in some sense, in one case, such as synesthesia, it appears to result in a conscious kind of conscious manifestation of maybe unconscious processes. In other cases, such as attention deficit or autism, the intensity is so much that or the hypersensitivity of the environment becomes so difficult for the person that it ends up sometimes becoming a deficit. So the question is, are these all of the same kind of disorder, or maybe just a difference of degree with the same kind, or are they really genuinely distinct disorders?
And Britt, you're looking for synesthetes, right? We have only a few seconds. How can people get in touch with you? You want to work with these people, obviously.
Yeah, you can go to our website, synestheseresearch.com, and you can contact us through that site. So that's probably the best way, or you can email us directly from the websites
We'll put a link to your website on our website at stlpublicradio.org. That'll probably be up a little bit later in the day. Our time is up. I want to thank you all so much for bringing this to our attention, what you're doing, and what is going on out there in the world. I'm sure very many of our people today just were totally unaware of this sort of thing was going on. Britt Bogard, thank you so much for
being
with us.
Thank you so much.
And Kristen Marlowe, thank you for being with us. Derek Amato and Daniel Kish, thank you guys so much for being with us long distance today. It was a pleasure talking to you, and your stories are fascinating indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. With you, Doc.
Thanks.
Same here. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about Hot City Theater's world premiere of a play involving social media, also about the Georges Braque exhibition at the Kemper Art Museum, and also with singer Michael Bolton. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts, including St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. Executive producers Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.